That's not a criticism. I forget what I had for breakfast.
Oh, yeah. So I was just wondering if this ties into the boundaries of, like, the 12 boundaries of the world falling into the 12.
Oh, okay, verse 19. Let's read verse 19. And it says, Deuteronomy 4:19, "And lest thou lift up thine eyes unto heaven, and when thou seest the sun and the moon, the stars, even all the host of heaven, shouldest be driven to worship them and serve them, which the Lord thy God hath divided unto all nations under the whole heaven." And his question has to deal with, is this line up with Deuteronomy chapter 32? In verse 8, he says in Deuteronomy chapter 32, verse 8, "When the Most High divided to the nations their inheritance, when he separated the sons of Adam, he set the bounds of the people according to the number of the children of Israel." Now, the difference between the two passages here, even though in verse 19 you find the word "God hath divided unto all nations," in Deuteronomy 4, what he's divided to all nations is in the chapter there, the sun and the moon and the stars and all the host of heaven. And that's what he's divided to all the nations. When he say divided, if you know anything about astronomy, you know that different parts of the world see different parts of the sky at the same time. So, and then you have a southern hemisphere with its constellations that we never see, and we have the northern constellations that the southern people never see. So it's divided unto the nations. It's divided up. Now, nobody on any night, no matter where you're at, in the northern hemisphere or the southern hemisphere, of course we know that those two are different, but in the northern hemisphere, if you would go out tonight and look up, you're in the middle of winter here, you'll see the winter constellations. And they will begin to come up as soon as it gets dark. Orion is now is pretty high up in the sky because it's a winter one. But if you would go over to England someplace, you'd see a whole different sky. In other words, he has divided the sky up by the constellations. And I guess, you know, if you wanted to make the case, now that I'm thinking about it, you know, the whole sky is divided into 12 constellations, which we call the zodiac. So even that, he's divided the sky up based on the 12. And, of course, all that goes back to the nation of Israel. Everything that God did, he divided based on the 12 tribes, because salvation is of the Jew. When we get out into eternity someplace, and you get into the new heavens and the new earth, that firmament, which we know is a second heaven, will actually be divided up into 12 sections, one for each tribe. We have that now in a very small way on planet Earth with the 12 signs of the zodiac. They actually portion out 12 portions of the sky. So if you're going to take that, we got to leave it the sun and the moon and the stars, but it would be divided unto heaven through the 12 signs of the zodiac. So, yes, it is. Now, while we're here, just so you get this one too, come over here to Deuteronomy 32 and then get Acts chapter 17 in another hand. In fact, let's go to, let me see here. Let's go to Acts 17 first. Keep your hand back in Deuteronomy, but let's go to Acts chapter 17. Now look at verse 26. Now we're in the book of Acts here, and you know we're getting a lot of information at this point. We're well into the establishment of the church here. And so he's making some statements, and we're dealing here with Paul preaching at Athens and some of the things that's going on there. And he makes a statement in verse 25. He says, neither is worshipped with men's, talking about God, neither is worshipped with men's hands, as though he needed anything, seeing he giveth to all life and breath and all things. And hath made of one blood, verse 26, all nations of men for to dwell on all the face of the earth, and hath determined the times before appointed and the bounds of their habitation. Now here's the reason he did that, verse 27, that they should seek the Lord, if happily they might feel after him and find him, though he be not far from every one of us. So you're going to find that even in the day that we live in today, that you're going to find 12 natural boundaries on this planet. And I'll give them to you here. You have North America, you have Central America, and then you have South America. Then you have Antarctica, and then the Arctic. Then you have Asia. Then you have Africa, then you have Australia, then you have the West Indies, then you have the East Indies, and then you have Greenland, and then you have Europe. Those are 12 land masses that, that are distinctly different. And I know right now that Antarctica and Antarctica is not your favorite vacation spot, but at the same time, in time it will be. And so what God did is he put 12 natural boundaries on this earth. And then he set the boundaries for man. And come on back to Deuteronomy now and look at Deuteronomy 32:8. Now this is what Acts is talking about here. Notice what he's saying, verse 8. When the Most High divided the nations their inheritance, when he separated the sons of Adam, he set the bounds of the people according, here it comes, to the number of the children of Israel. So he put 12 natural boundaries based on 12 tribes. And that's what you have. So when you begin to see that, and you realize that God's original plan was to put men in boundaries by which they could find the Lord. The problem that man has, and this starts all the way back after the flood, after the fall. And originally, if Adam and Eve would not have got into the mess that they got into, what would have happened probably is as this thing would have went on and on and on, you would have seen these 12 boundaries be used. Remember now, there was no polar caps, North Pole or South Pole, before the fall. So it was green vegetation. It was everything that it was a natural place where people could live. All that didn't happen until after the fall took place. So those 12 natural boundaries originally were God's setup on this earth, that's the way it would have went when it started. Once it fell in Genesis chapter 3, man fell, then the thing that man now continually does, and this is where it messes up everything that God is trying to do. What man does from this point on is he keeps getting out of bounds. He's not satisfied with his bounds. This is the this is the mark of the Gentiles. You'll notice that when God dealt with the nation of Israel, he gave them one piece of land in the Middle East. And it runs about 1,500 miles in a triangular shape from Babylon to Egypt and then up to Mount Ararat where Moses or Noah comes off the boat, the ark, and everything in between there. And he gave them one piece of ground. And then everything else would have been divided up if man would not have fallen, would have been divided up according to those 12 boundaries. And then God would have taken it from there once the earth got full, Isaiah chapter 9, verse 6 and 7. Once the fall comes, man then is not satisfied to be in the bounds that God gave him. When Noah's boys come out of the ark, you'll find that those three boys represent three basic races that move into three different parts of the earth. Ham goes south into Egypt, Africa, and those areas. Japheth goes would go west into Europe. And Shem goes east into the Middle East, China, Japan, and all of those places from there. You're going to find that the rest of Gentile history, once that happens, immediately you begin to see where everybody wants to get out of their bounds. The whole Old Testament is Hamites and Japhethites trying to take what God gave the Shemites, getting out of their bounds. And this is the problem that is exasperated today to the point where it's not even recognizable anymore. And it's a thing where once the fall came, then the dividing of the 12 boundaries went out the window in the sense that now the curse is here. Now Antarctica are frozen beyond belief. And everything kind of breaks down at that point. But originally, that's not the way that it was. And then God was going to set those bounds with Adam and Eve's offsprings that they got their land that for the purpose that they might find the Lord. And, of course, you'll find that Japheth and Shemites and Hamites, that's all they've done is try to get out of their boundaries and to take more land. The understanding Gentile history without a Bible perspective is actually nothing more than all three races. When I say the Shemites, I'm not necessarily just talking about the Jews. I'm talking about the Japanese, the Korean, the Chinese, and those groups too. They're all Shemites. All history is at that point is one nation trying to suppress and overcome another nation that they can take over their land. When you get into Daniel, and you get into Daniel, and he lays out the Gentile nations, when the times of the Gentiles start, this is just exactly what you have. It goes with Babylon. Babylon gets beat. Well, it started with Egypt. Egypt gets overtaken with Babylon. Babylon gets overtaken with Persia. Persia gets overtaken with Greece. Greece gets overtaken with Rome. That's all it is. All of those nations are simply getting out of the bounds that God intended them to be in to conquer the world. And that's what you have today. That's exactly nations today, their boundaries of their nation. We don't have anybody living in the 12 boundaries now because that was before the fall. But what we have now in a similar sense is nations and their boundaries. America has boundaries. Germany has boundaries. Russia has boundaries. China has boundaries. Their national boundaries. And they're not satisfied to be within that. Putin wasn't satisfied with Russia. He wanted Ukraine. Hitler wasn't satisfied with Germany. He wanted everything else. Japan was not satisfied with Japan. They wanted China. They wanted Burma. They wanted Thailand. They wanted everything in the Pacific. And they'd have taken over the world because that is what it is. Now, we talk about race. Race is one of the most misunderstood concepts anywhere in anywhere in life, because we always try to make race one race against another. And truly, there is racial issues, all down through history. You know, we talk about the black and the white racial issues today, but back in the 1800s, it was against the Chinese. They were hated over on the West Coast, and back in the early 1900s, in New York City itself, you had all the immigrants coming over, and you had the Italians, you had the Chinese, you had the Japanese, you had the all of these ethnic groups were in one city, and they carved out their own little boundaries. And you didn't walk through their boundaries. But that's the way history has always been. History is nothing more, from a Gentile standpoint, is one Gentile nation overcoming another Gentile nation so he can have what he has. And that's what it is. When you put God into the equation of it, it takes all that aside, and then you actually see that everything in history, no matter what the Gentiles doing, God is using what the Gentiles are doing to bring the nation of Israel to the forefront, 1948, and pretty soon will establish them as the only world nation that all the other nations will have to come to get anything from God. So the original boundaries, and you find in these two places, Acts and then Deuteronomy, dealing with the natural boundaries that God originally set up for man to be able to find and have a relationship with God. It got destroyed when the fall came. The boundaries that Aaron's question is talking about would be the 12 zodiacs that compass the earth. They go around the earth this way. And wherever you're at on the earth, you're seeing a different part of that, a different boundary of that second heaven. So that's what you're dealing with. It's one of the most fascinating things you'll ever get into, but it's quite entailed. So that's what you got. They're connected, but they're not connected. Yeah. My next question here is in Mark chapter 9. And there again, this is your question here, Sharon. So if you can remember it, we'll have you ask it. I have it in my phone. Let's get to Mark chapter 9. I just want to make sure I understand what you want. I don't want to just try to answer it and not answer what you need. Let me get to Mark 9 here. Mark 9, all right. 9:16 or 9 whatever.
21.
Okay, I'll read it. And he asked his father, how long is it ago since this came unto him? And he said, of a child.
We've talked a lot about questions lately. And this is the only passage that he asks him that. And I was just wondering why he asked it. I thought it could be that something happened in the child's life that he wanted the father to acknowledge, but it doesn't say that. So,
you know, I had another question, Justin. By the way, his dad, he'll be here a little later tonight, but he called me, and his dad was in the hospital having some heart problems tonight, so he went over to spend some time with him. So pray for Justin's dad. But he asked me the same question along those same lines, what was the significance of one place in the Gospels just saying that the cock crowed once, and then when you go to the other place, you find that it actually crowed two times. And he, kind of like yours, you want to know what's going on here with this question. Why did he ask that? And, you know, and he, because it's not found in the other accounts. And his question is similar, because that cock crowing is not found in the other accounts either. It's just found in that one. And, you know, my answer to that, and I'm going to take your answer a little bit farther, but there's not always some great doctrinal, spiritual significance in that. Now, there is in yours, and I'm going to show you how you develop that here in a minute. A lot of places in the Gospels, it just simply comes down to he doesn't lay out the whole story in one place because of what I've said before. Because if he did, then we wouldn't study it. And so in one place, he'll say where the cock crowed once, and then that's all you read, then you think that. But when you get the other account, then you find he crowed two times. But in that other account, you may find other stuff where there may not be any real significance in the doctrinal issue of the cock crowing two times. There's going to be other stuff in that chapter that will add to what you're trying to get your study going and investigating and what you're looking at. Do I need to move? Something, what was that? I can't see back there. Something upstairs? Oh, okay. Fine. So that's what you have in his question about. Sometimes he just does it that way, so you study all the passages. I mean, this is a stupid statement. The Lord understands human nature. You bet he does. And he knows how lazy we all are. And that's why he wrote the book in such a, I'm going to use the word complicated fashion, even though it's not. If you just follow the basic rules, the Bible really unlocks itself. But if you don't, then, you know, then you miss a lot. And there's been a lot of young Christians, a lot of older Christians that just do not get into the Gospels or any part of the Bible, but especially the Gospels, because you've got to get all four accounts together. Now, there'll be times where you only have one account of it, and then that's what you have. Other places, you'll find where it says two places, and then that's all you have. Sometimes it's all four, and that's what you have. But you've got to do the work to lay it out, because of what all that's in all together. And then you got to put it all together, and then you get the picture of what you got going. So in his case, I don't know of any major doctrinal significance about the cock crowing two times, one here and then told you he did it twice. If there is, I don't know what it is. But it's a thing where not everything means some big doctrinal truth, but it'll lead you to other things in that chapter. Now, your question here, let's go back to yours. Your question was in 21. And it said, and he asked his father, how long is it ago since this came unto him? And he said, of a child. Your first question was there something ongoing here that the reason why he asked that question? That was basically your question, correct? Okay. Now, here again, if I was reading this and I came to that verse, the first thing I would do is go back to my four rules that I'm going to follow with the Gospels. And I would use that as the basis for finding out why he asked that question. I wouldn't assume or ask myself, I wonder if there is something here that he knows that I don't know. That would never be the issue. The issue is, why did he ask that question? And the issue is, the only way you begin to unearth that is to go back to your four rules. One, get all the counts together. The main rule here that you would want to follow is that every story in the Bible is going to be a picture of the nation of Israel in their spiritual condition in some way, shape, or form. So once I already know that, before I even begin to look at this, I know that's what I've got here someplace. He asked that question based on that fact. He didn't ask the question because was there something that happened in that guy's life back in the day. He didn't ask that question for that. He asked that question based on the rules that he gave me, that every story in the Gospels is going to be some form of picture of Israel's spiritual condition. Once I know that, then I don't ever look anywhere else. I start with that premise, and then I work through the chapter, as I'm going to show you how to do it, and we'll see what we have here. Now, second thing. Verse 21 says, and he asked his father, how long is it ago since this came unto him? And he said, of a child. I would never just lift that verse out and say, what does this verse mean, without putting it into the context of the whole story? Because there lies the answer. I mean, you can take that verse out and you do whatever you want to do with it. You make it go wherever you want to make it go. You could suppose it's this or suppose it's that. But once you put it back in the context of the story, then you're locked into the context. See? That's what you got to learn to do. So let's do that. And that would take us back to verse 16. And he says here, and he asked the scribes, what question with them? And one of the multitude answered and said, Master, I have brought unto you thee my son, which hath a dumb spirit. And whithersoever he taketh him, he teareth him, and he foameth and gnasheth with his teeth, and pineth away. And I spake to thy disciples that they should cast him out, and they could not. Now, I'm doing a little investigative study here. I got a guy, a kid, who has got some kind of unclean spirit. Well, right away, I'm going back to Matthew chapter 12, where you find the man who had an unclean spirit, and it left him, and then he brings in seven other spirits, and the end result is, and I know that man is the nation of Israel, because he says at the end of that story, so shall it be to this generation. Bang, that set my context. This kid here who has a demon, or whatever he's got, is a picture of Israel in their spiritual condition who has a demonic influence spirit in their life. Notice he's got a dumb spirit. Look at verse 25. These are the pieces you pick out of here. And when Jesus saw that the people came running together, he rebuked the foul spirit, saying unto him, thou dumb and what? What? Yeah. What? Israel's got an hearing problem. We learned that a couple of weeks ago when the guy got his ear cut off by Peter. So we automatically begin to see the pieces fall into place here. But you got to follow the rules, guys. You can't just read it and then decide maybe this is what it is. You got the context right there that will lead you right down to wherever you're going to get the answer at. Now, watch this. Verse 17. And one of the multitude answered and said, Master, I have brought unto thee my son, which hath a dumb spirit. And whatsoever he taketh, he teareth him, and foameth, and gnasheth, and his teeth, and pineth away. And I spake to thy disciples, but they could not cast him out, and they could not. Now, the second thing we see here is the disciples, who were all kinds of miracle things, they couldn't do this one. Now, there's a reason for that. There's a reason why in this story, in this picture, they couldn't do that. Now, look at verse 19. Here's another key. Where he answered him and said, O faithless generation. Then he just connected this kid to a faithless generation that is a nation of Israel. That's what he said back in Matthew chapter 12 or 13. I can't remember sure where it was, where he had the unclean spirit. The same generation. You see, you've got to connect the pieces. This is what I tried to tell you Sunday about, you know, salvation or anything in the Bible has to do with the evidence. You've got to have the evidence. And the evidence is the key to what you you're trying to accomplish in putting it together. So you got to follow the rules. You got to look at the key words. You got to use other places that are going to tie it all together. I mean, when I start coming down through this, the first thing I see is this kid is a demon-possessed kid. My mind goes right back to Matthew 12 where you have the man who's a picture of the nation of Israel. That's what this story's about. And there's a reason why the nation, these 12 apostles, can't cast this guy out. Let's work on that one. All right, let's go on here. And he answered him and saith, O faithless generation, how long shall I be with you? How long shall I suffer you? Bring him unto me. Now, the thing I would ask myself, he's dealing with this kid, he's dealing with his dad, and he's dealing with a few other people that are around here. Why would he make a reference to a generation? Because he's talking about the nation of Israel, that generation that he talked about back in Matthew. And they brought him, verse 20, and when he saw him, straightway the spirit tear him, and he fell on the ground and wallowed foaming. And he asked his father how long it is ago since this came unto him, and he said, of a child. Now that's your second key, because when you go back in the book of Exodus, you'll find that he makes the reference that when Israel comes out of Egypt, he's just a child. And Israel begins to have his problems with God from that point on. What we have here is a picture in this story of a child who's a picture of the nation of Israel, that faithless generation, who's got a dumb spirit and a deaf spirit that cannot hear the things of God, and he's demon-possessed, as it's laid out in Matthew chapter 12 and Matthew chapter 13. Okay. And oftentimes, it hath cast him into the fire and into the waters to destroy him. But if thou canst do anything, have compassion on us and help us. And straightway the father of the child cried out and said with tears, Lord, I believe, help thy mine unbelief. And when Jesus saw that the people came running together, he rebuked the foul spirit, saying unto him, thou dumb and deaf spirit. Now we already covered that. I charge thee, come out of him and enter no more into him. And the spirit cried and rent him tore and came out of him, and he was as one dead, inasmuch that many said, he is dead. But Jesus took him by the hand and lifted him up, and he arose. Now, there's Ezekiel chapter 36 and Ezekiel chapter 37. Israel is a dead, dusty, dry bones, and then God brings them back to life. This kid is a picture of the nation of Israel. All right, let's go on. Jesus took him by the hand and lifted him up, and he arose, just like Israel will do in Ezekiel 36 and 37. And when he was come into the house, that's the whole house of Israel right there. His disciples asked him privately, why could we not cast him out? All right, here's the reason why they could not. Because it's part of the story of the nation of Israel. Here it comes. You have this through the whole story. The nation of Israel is dumb, deaf, and demon-possessed. Okay? The apostles can't do anything to help him. They have to bring him to Jesus. Jesus gets it done, tells us very clearly that this kid fits in all the scenarios of the nation of Israel. And then when he everybody thinks he's dead, which is Israel at the end, God resurrects the nation of Israel, Ezekiel 36, and they live and go into the millennium, and you know where that story goes. This is what you got. Now, the disciples come to him and say, how come we couldn't do this? Ah, here it comes. Here it comes. Verse 29, and he said unto them, this kind can come forth by nothing but prayer and fasting. And he departed thence and passed through Galilee, and would not that any man should know it. Now here it comes. For he taught his disciples and said unto them, the Son of Man is delivered into the hands of men, and they shall kill him. And after that he is killed, he shall rise the third day. That's a picture of Christ coming out of the tomb on 3 days after he was crucified. It's also a picture of the third day of the second coming of Christ. The reason why the disciples could not heal this kid is because that kid's a picture of the nation of Israel, and the only one that can heal the nation of Israel is the Lord Jesus Christ at the second coming of Christ. See what you got? I mean, you got to follow the rules. Now, what I just laid out is not hard if you follow the rules. You've got to stay with the rules on the four Gospels. Now, when you get into the other books in the Bible, I get it. You have other sets of rules that you want to follow. Basically, every book will have its own set of structural rules that you follow. I get that. The New Testament, past the Gospels, will have its own set of structural rules. I get that. When you get into the Gospels, you're into a whole other world. You're into a time period where you have four books that are written about the same time. You don't have that any other place in the Bible. And God has chosen in those four accounts to not give you everything in one book that really happened on any given event. You have to get all the accounts together, but you never forget that whatever you're reading, the bottom line will be about Israel getting restored in the millennium and getting the kingdom of heaven. You got to follow those four rules. And the moment I would have read this story, as I've read any story, before I went anywhere, before I asked any question, before I ever thought anything, I would immediately know, even though I don't have it all together yet, that this is a picture of the nation of Israel and their spiritual condition. That solves one major problem. You've just established the context. Once you have a context, then you can begin to work your way through it using other places in the Bible. I went back to Matthew 11 and 12 and 13, and other places where you can, the third day, you begin to put all of the pieces together as you see the story and understand what the context is. Now, you see how I did that, Sharon? It's just a thing where you never start, first of all, you never start with just one verse, lift it out and say, okay, you know, wonder what's going on here. Well, you'll never figure out what's going on here. You take that verse and put it back into context. You got to take the verse and get it back in the story. Lifting it out of the story, it can mean anything. But putting it into the context will always mean what it really is intended to mean. So again, I just keep driving that point home that you have got to ask yourself, you know, in the Gospels, you've got to follow those four rules. And if you don't, and this is, when I talk about discipline, you know, we talk about discipline in a lot of different ways. Discipline, you know, well, I don't go here, I don't drink this, I don't smoke this, you know, all these things because I don't want to do that because that's not what Christians do. So I'm disciplining myself for that, against that. I get that, and that's true. But another form of discipline, which is, to me, the greatest form of a discipline for a child of God, is your discipline within the structure of the Word of God. You have to follow the rules. You have to follow the protocol. You know, if you don't do that, then you're never going to establish anything meaningful out of the Bible, and you're always going to be looking at places and wondering what this verse means when you'll never figure it out until you follow the basic rules and put it into the context of the story you're reading. And then, like I said, on the four Gospels, it's crucial because they are four books unto themselves. They're not like any other books in the Bible. And, you know, you've got to really, really follow the rules on them. I mean, you get into 1 Corinthians, 2 Corinthians, and you can take a verse out of context because it's written to the church. I mean, my God shall supply all your need according to the riches and glory in Christ Jesus. You can lift that verse out, and you're okay with that. You can't lift the verse out of the Gospels and do all that. And I think sometimes because we do that in the New Testament with Paul, that we think we can do that in the Gospels. That's a lack of discipline. Discipline will tell you when you can do what you can do and what you can't with wherever you're at in the Bible. And then you got to discipline yourself to that. It's a thing where you have to train yourself that whatever you're looking at, the first thing you ask yourself before you go anywhere is the context. And I don't understand why most of God's people can't do that, but most of them cannot. And it all comes down to a lack of self-discipline that you just discipline yourself to do that. If you got to make a list of things on a 3x5 card before you ever get into your Bible, that you look at that 3x5 card and it's got the four or five things you have to do on there, then do that. I did. That's how I learned how to do it. I just, you know, it's a thing where you've got to train yourself how to think at different places in the Bible. And that's just what you got to do. So that's a great study, and that's a great story. And it's one that when you begin to look at it and see it, again, you just follow the rules, and the rules will just take you home, and you'll be okay with it, and you'll be good to go from there. Anybody have a... Yes, back here, Sarah. I think that's Sarah. I got my reading glasses on. I don't have my people glasses. Is this another question?
It's the same question from Sharon.
I'm sorry?
It's like part of Sharon's question.
Same type of question?
It's part, yeah.
Okay, go ahead.
In this...
Are you asking this for your husband? Because you're looking at him and he's agreeing.
No. In the story, the dad of the son uses the word master when he's talking to Jesus. Does that mean anything?
What now?
The dad of the son uses the word master when he addresses Jesus.
What verse are you in?
That's in verse 17.
What verse?
Verse 17.
18?
17.
17. And one of the multitude answered and said, Master, I have brought thee my son, which hath a dumb spirit. You're asking about why they called him master?
Yeah.
Typically, and this is not true all of the time. I know I have mentioned to you before that Judas never called him Lord. He always called him master. You're going to find that master is a proper term to use in this time period here. But if you look here, look at verse 24. And straightway the father of the child cried out and said with tears, Lord. So he's using him interchangeably, which is would be okay to do. But when you find a guy like Judas who never does, all he does is call him master, there's a reason for that. And, of course, we know the reason for that of who Judas is. So it's a proper term to be used. It would go along with, like, the word rabbi. They're kind of used interchangeably on the root meanings. But you can use that. It would be okay to use it interchangeably, which he does here, because it was a proper term that could be used. So every time you find somebody doing that, you want to look, as I did, to see if he just called him Lord someplace else. So then he's using it properly. If I found some guy that, and I can't think of a top of my head, somebody that just used the word master on and on and on again, then I would look at that a little deeper and see what we're dealing with there. Yeah. Good observational. Good. That's how you learn. We got one in the back here. Just another question?
I just wanted to know your four rules of the gospel.
Oh, that's okay. Let's see. Let's see who's been paying attention. Who wants to come on down here with the mic? Who wants to stand up and give the four rules of the gospels? Ah, now we'll see. Anybody? Oh, come on down here. Let him do it. I know you got them, Aaron, but get all right, here we go. What were the four rules, young man?
Rule number one.
Rule number one.
Everything is for a reason. Rule number two.
Everything is in there for a reason. Rule number two.
Every person and event pictures Israel's spiritual condition.
Every person or story in there will be a picture of Israel's spiritual condition. When you took your note, you missed story, but go ahead.
Rule number three, get all four accounts together.
Rule number three, get all four accounts together.
And rule number four,
yes,
all this material connects to the Old Testament.
And connects all to the Old Testament and connects to the second coming of Christ, Israel getting the kingdom. You'll want to remember that the theme of the Gospels fundamentally is the kingdom of heaven. Now, I know the kingdom of God is here because Christ is king of both kingdoms, and he is here, brings both kingdoms with him when he comes. But primarily, at the first coming of Christ, he's bringing the kingdom to Israel, which is the kingdom of heaven. So everything in there is going to be around those lines. So. All right. Now, the next one here is I was asked. I better read this one. Could you possibly explain and draw out on your whiteboard Deuteronomy chapter 1, 2, and 3, mainly the route the nation of Israel took and the battles that took place? Also, are there any books in the bookstore or that I could get off the internet that to map out parts of the Bible like this? Well, let's go over to Deuteronomy chapter 1, 2, and 3 here. And I can help you with this a little bit. Now, in Deuteronomy chapter 1, 2, and 3, you have a brief, loose history of what Israel faced as they went into the land. And his question has to do with the battles that they fought and they took place. And to find that, you wouldn't go to Deuteronomy chapter 1, 2, and 3 because it's not a very concise accounting of it all. You would think it would be simply because it talks about it, but you want to get more than that does. Fundamentally, if you look at Deuteronomy in the first three chapters, here's what it focuses on. First off, in chapter 1, it says, "These be the words which Moses spake unto all Israel on this side of Jordan in the wilderness and the plain over against the Red Sea between Paran and Tophel and Laban and Hazeroth Diazhab." Now, again, it's hard for me to start reading something and everything start popping at me. First of all, Deuteronomy, you've heard me talk about the last things that people say. Deuteronomy is the last book that he writes, Moses writes to the nation of Israel. So there's going to be a lot of key things in it. There again, you got to discipline yourself to remember that. But here's what he wants to get across here. He says, verse 2, "There are 11 days' journey from Horeb by the way of Mount Seir under Kadesh Barnea." And Kadesh Barnea is where they sent the spies in, if you remember, we'll get to in Joshua here. And so it says it's 11 days' journey from Sinai. So what they do is they come out of Egypt, they form up on Sinai. Mount Sinai is the kickoff sport. And this is where Moses is told to take the shoes off his feet. And this begins to mark the route of the second coming of Christ that Christ is going to take when he comes back at the second coming. And he comes back to Mount Sinai. That's where he touches down, where Moses told to take his shoes off. And then he follows the exact same route that Israel takes coming up through their 40 years wandering, comes over to Jordan, where this is where Joshua meets him, and he's told to take his shoes off. It marks the beginning and the end of the route. And then he crosses over Gilgal, crosses over Jordan, goes into the Mount of Olives, goes into the Olives, and then goes into the Eastern Gate. And so this is, and that route is actually laid out for you in the Bible pretty clearly, that you can follow it. But the point he's making here is the fact that that they're leaving and they go to Sinai. And then he says, verse 2, that there are 11 days' journey from Horeb by the way of Mount Seir unto Kadesh Barnea, where they send the spies in. So what he's telling us here is that it would have taken 11 days for these 2+ million people to get from Sinai to to the promised land. It was an 11-day journey. Then in verse 3, and it came to pass in the 40th year, but it took them 40 years. And the thing, this is the theme of Deuteronomy. So you want to see this. Deuteronomy means deutero, dudo, duet, two, second giving of the law. And Israel did not do what was right with the law when it came to the people the first time. They didn't give it to their children. The people had let it go by the wayside. And so one of the reasons that he has them wander for 40 years is that the generation that comes out of Egypt dies off. They don't get to go into the promised land. But their children do. But because they did not give the children the law, he has to give them the law second time. And this is why we have the book of Deuteronomy. You'll want to remember that. So Deuteronomy is going to be built around the fact that this is they didn't get it right the first time. And instead of getting to the promised land in 11 days, it took them 40 years. Now, I'm going to answer this question, but you can't expect me not to hit the inspirational side of this. That's a picture of how long it takes you to get to the spiritual place in your life where you really have a working relationship with God and the Word of God. I'm not going to say you're going to get there in 11 days, but some of you aren't got there in 40 years either, so what's your point? It's the thing where you can get there either in a short period of time or 40 years, and some people never get there. So that's the whole deal here. So what you got in the first three chapters here is all this stuff that's being redone, and so he's going through the things. Now look at verse 39 of chapter 1. Here's the point that he's trying to make. And so you want to get this down first. He says in verse 39, moreover, your little ones, those are your children that were born and come out of Egypt, once you came out of Egypt, which he said should be a prey, and your children, which is that day, had no knowledge between good and evil. They're under the accountability age. They shall go in thither, and unto them I will give it, and they shall possess it. But as for you, turn you and take your journey into the wilderness by the way of the Red Sea. So they wander for 40 years till they all die. This is the gist of what you've got here. And they go up against some opposition. They do. But this is the other thing that he tries to tell you in Deuteronomy. And he tells you this in chapter 2, verse 20. And he says, that also was accounted a land of giants. Giants dwelt therein in old time. That's Genesis chapter 6. And the Ammonites call them Zamzumis. I think there's a ride out at Worlds of Fun. You got to be at least 6 foot tall to ride it. But anyway, a people great and many and tall, as the Anakins, but the Lord destroyed them before them, and they possessed them and dwelt in their stead. Now, you're told again back in Genesis that there were giants in the earth in those days, and then just a little phrase, and also after that. Those sons of God that come down in Genesis chapter 6 get wiped out in the flood. When they come down from left their first estate, took on some kind of mortal human bodies, they lost the spiritual ability that the fallen angels had of being able to transcend back and forth off the earth. There's been a lot of speculation what was the thing that changed that, and I'm not going to get into that, but it looks like it was one particular thing that they did that fixed their wagon that they couldn't get back, but we ain't gonna get into that tonight. It's a thing where they couldn't get off the earth. So when the flood came, they drowned like everybody else. You are hidden from all this today because they came back down again at some point. And this is what he's telling us in Deuteronomy chapter 2, and that these giants came back again, and they're called the sons of Anakim here. You're going to find that Goliath was the remnant of the giant that David killed. David winds up killing the rest of the giants and then completely wipes them off the earth. Goliath had four brothers. And it's a thing where they all get wiped out finally with David. But they are back in the land. And you are, like everything else today, you are probably only told what somebody higher than you want you to know. The idea of giants on the earth has been one of the most hidden concepts down through history. There are more records of men finding giant skeletons that are 16 feet tall that are covered up that you never hear about, or when you do hear about it, it's blown out of proportion, that it's not really what it seems to be or what it is. But the evidence of the giants on this earth is quite astounding. It's just the fact that if they admitted there were giants, then they got a real problem, because then somebody has to connect it back to Genesis chapter 6, and that means the Bible just might know what it's talking about. So that's what you got. So you have that all up in the first three chapters, along with some of the battles they fight. Now, to answer your question, if you want a in-depth study of the battles that they fight, you got to go to the book of Joshua. Deuteronomy will give you the second giving, and it goes through so many different aspects. But if you want to get the battles down, then this is where you got to go. And I will give you what I can on it. I will tell you this, there is no way that I can do this on a whiteboard, because I don't have, you have to list all the cities in the right places. And the best way you can do this, and he asked me if there was a book out there. I'm sure that there are, there's some books out there. The one that I have, and I looked in the books out there, on the historical thing, there is a book out there that has it in. But my book is about that thick and about that big, and it's called Erderman's Handbook of the Bible. It's been out of print for a long, long, long time. But it's called Erderman's Handbook of the Bible. And in that book, it goes through each book of the Bible and breaks it down. Now, again, inspirational, doctrinal, nothing. But what it does do is give you the historical accuracy of what is playing out during these books. And actually, it shows you the maps of where they're doing what they're doing. But it all comes down to basically a breakdown of Joshua, which I'm going to give you here, that will help you you put it all together. Like I said, Deuteronomy chapter 1, 2, 3 is focusing on something else, even though it has some battles in it. Now, when Joshua goes into the land, and there's so much good inspirational stuff in this, he follows a brilliant battle plan that generals have used centuries down the line, which is a fundamental Bible principle. He follows the divide and conquer format in his military campaigns. When I say divide and conquer, when he goes in, he splits the northern part of the land from the southern part. Therefore, they can't hook up together to defeat him. He's already split the opposition, that they are now cut off from each other. Then it was a matter of which section he wanted to fight first. And I'll bring you through that in a moment. The divide and conquer concept you know, is a great military strategy, but it is the fundamental basic rule of your salvation, because when you got saved, Colossians chapter 2 says that the spiritual operation of God, spiritual circumcision took place, and he divided your soul from your flesh. And because he divided, once you get saved, you can conquer, see, everything in life. So the divide and conquer goes all the way back to God's first aspect of salvation. When you got saved, he divided your soul, but then he also separated you, sanctification, from the world. He divided your soul from your flesh, and then he divided you from the world. Because he divided, you now have the ability to overcome the world and conquer. See, that's where it comes from. So even though it is a standard, solid military tactic in some scenarios, it's a basic fundamental rule of the Bible about salvation and everything that God does. That's how you see how those things work. Now, here's the breakdown of Joshua. And the first five chapters, chapter 1 through chapter 5, this is where they cross over. And it's here that where he sees the angel of the Lord, and he's told to take the shoes off his feet. That marks the second time that that happens in the Bible. The first time's in Exodus. And then you have in chapters 5 and 6 is where they take Jericho. Jericho was a strong point. They had to take Jericho face on. And again, when you study the taking of Jericho, everything in Joshua is a picture of the second coming of Christ. And the battle, every battle in there is a picture of the battle of Armageddon in one way or the other. When you have the battle of Jericho, you have the Jericho is a walled up city. Jericho is called the accursed city. They march around the city 7 times, 7 days, 7 years of the tribulation. They blow the trumpet, Revelation, and the walls come down, and it's a second coming. But once they take Jericho, they've neutralized that central strong point. Now they have divided the land north and south. So in chapters 9 and 10, they take on the southern campaign, and they defeat those nations that are down on the southern portion. And the reason why I can't draw that out is because I don't know where all those nations are at. You can get on a Bible map and you can see it. Obviously, in 8 and 9, one of those cities is Ai. You get that one. Then in chapter 11, they start the northern campaign. Then in chapter 12, he'll give you a list of the nations that they conquered and they defeated. In chapters 13 up through chapter 23, this all takes place after the battles. This is where each tribe gets their inheritance and gets the land that is given to them because of the inheritance. And then in chapter 24, this again is another great chapter. This is the last thing that Joshua says in his farewell address to the nation of Israel, which is quite incredible. So you can see that what he does is he divides and he conquers. He divides the two, north and south, neutralizes Jericho, and then begins the southern campaigns with Ai, and then goes down and defeats those. The northern people could not come down and help them because he's got his line of troops there that would stop them from coming down. So once he defeats the south, then he can put all of his forces going to the northern campaign, and he defeats those nations. Now, if you got, and I'm sure that there's books out there, I don't know of anything we have directly in the bookstore. That Erdemann's Handbook of the Bible is a really, really good book to historically give you things that happened and the way that they happened.
Like I said, doctrinally, it's worthless. If I can find one or two of those, I'll try to pick them up and put them out there. I don't want to get rid of mine because I use it all the time. But it's a thing where, like I said, it's a very thick book, and it's very extensive. A lot of these books like that, and I tell you this, you know, in building your own libraries, these books are invaluable. You're not going to get doctrinal stuff. You're not going to get stuff that it really, you know, lays the inspirational application. You're not going to get, you know, Jericho as a type of the second coming of Christ. You're not going to get any of that. These guys, as blind as a bat, backing in backwards when it comes to that kind of stuff. But you really can't screw history up too much when it comes to biblical history. You can some places, but for the most part, they don't. And you're going to get into places in your Bible that you're not sure how it all played out. I mean, you can get the inspirational, and you can see the types, and you can see the doctrinal, and you know what you got. But the events, like these battles, you get reading it, but you can't get a mind's eye on exactly how it all went. These books will help you do that. Just like the Erdemann's book will show you the northern campaigns and the southern campaigns. When I did the book of Joshua on the website years ago, you know, when I broke down each book, those are the outlines I would have used to bring you through. Because Joshua is the book that shows you those campaigns and those battles. Joshua was a brilliant tacticianist. And, of course, he had God on his side. But you're going to find that he did a masterful job in doing what he did. He didn't wipe it all out. You're going to find that, you know, Joshua got him into the land. He defeated those nations, but there was a lot of remnants of those nations that held on. And, you know, they became the problems for Israel. This was the problem coming up through the book of Judges. This was the problem with Saul when Saul made an alliance with, you know, some of the people, nations that he should not have made alliances with. When David comes in, you know, David is a picture of the second coming of Christ in his 40-year reign. What David does is he wipes out all of the last remaining nations. When David is done at the end of his life, Israel now has no enemies within their borders. They may have enemies outside their borders, but David has subdued, wiped out, killed everybody in the land that was a threat to the nation of Israel. That is why he is a picture of the second coming of Christ, because that's what the Lord does at the second coming. Now, after he goes, Solomon comes on the throne. And Solomon reigns for another 40 years. And during Solomon's 40 years of reign, this is a picture of the millennial reign of Christ. There are no wars, there are no battles, there are no upheavals, there's no nothing. It's the 40 years of man's existence in 6,000 years of history. In 6,000 years of history, there is only 40 years that this earth was as close to the millennium as you could ever want it to be. During that time, everything about Solomon's reign is a picture of the millennial reign of Christ. You have the king, queen of Sheba coming up from Africa. She communes with him. She makes statements that people and nations will make to the Lord in the millennium. Happy are thy people, happy are the land, happy is this, happy this. This is where happy hour came from, hopefully. And then, of course, we see that when the Ethiopian eunuch, all the way up into Acts 8, when he's going to Jerusalem, you know what he's following? He's following what the Queen of Sheba had brought back 600, 700, 800 years before his time. And that was still going around in Africa about what she saw in Jerusalem. And he still thinks it's there. That's why God had to send him, Philip, to get him straightened out on the death, burial, and resurrection.
But that 40 years is the closest time in man's 6,000 years of history where the kingdom was as close to being here as it could be here. It was established. Solomon established it. But he only established it after David, a type of Christ at the second coming, had wiped out all the nations. Joshua, that's why Joshua in the book of Joshua is a picture of the second coming of Christ. Every battle in there will be a battle that's a picture. It's just the fact that Joshua didn't wipe them all out. David, and the reason for that is God tells us that he left some of the nations there to prove the nation of Israel, to see what they would do. But David then, when we get into the establishment of the kingdom of heaven to Israel, David wipes out all the nations, Solomon establishes the kingdom, and it falls apart again. So, that's what you got. So, yeah, you want to get that. You can go back in your Bible maps, and if you could find a book. I'm thinking of me, and there was a book out there The Campaigns of Joshua, or something like that. I can't remember what it was, but I'm sure there's some books out there. But if you can just take that simple outline and begin with that, then you can see how it goes, and then you can go back to your Bible map. Problem is with the Bible map, it doesn't have all those cities listed on it, so you don't know where you're at. This is why you got to get some help where somebody else kind of drew it out for you, but we'll hold up with there. All right, well, a couple of announcements here. The good thing, AJ and Patrick and Sarah, little Tyler, went home from the hospital today. Praise the Lord for that. Justin's dad, I talked to you about that. Keep him in your prayer. Tonight is the last night. If you're going to be a worker for camp, you need to get signed up, wherever that sign up is, and get on that list so we'll get going on that. And don't forget, I don't know what to tell you. Super Chiefs pulled it out. They won the Super Bowl. So I guess we won't. We just have to have the Chiefs Super Bowl party here and see what happens. But anyway, sign up for that so I know how much food to buy. That's coming up not this weekend, but the following weekend. And it'll be a fun time just to hang out and be together. Volleyball applications, please get that. And then I need to see the following ladies in my office. You're not in trouble. But I need Brooke. Is Brooke here tonight? I didn't see. She's not here tonight. She's where?
She's with the kids.
Oh, she's with the kids. Would you take it upon yourself that when we're dismissed, you go back and tell Brooke that I need to see her in my office? Hey, tell her she's really in trouble and I need to see her in my office. I need Brooke, Katie, Sierra, Stephanie, Maddie, Kenzie, Amanda, Logan. Is Ashley here tonight? I don't think she is. I'll catch her Sunday. And then Caitlin, okay? If you go into my office as soon as we're done here, I'll have a quick meeting with you guys. And so sign up for everything. Let's have a word of prayer. Thank you. Good questions. I'll get to the rest of them next week. They'll be at the top of my list. And keep them coming. And remember, guys, you got to follow the rules when it comes to the Gospels. You got to discipline yourself. Work at it. And I'm serious. You know, I've told husbands before when they were goofball husbands that couldn't figure life out with their wives to make a checkoff list of things that you have to look at, you know, before you get out of bed in the morning to know this is what I got to do. That's what you got to do. Because, you know, after a while, I forgot, doesn't cut it anymore. And, but when I started my Bible,